Center is Dr. Christina Fowler. Dr. Fowler is a senior research analyst at RTI and project director for the OPA-funded FPAR compilation project. As project director, she oversees the FPAR data system website and analysis and dissemination of FPAR data. She received her PhD in health policy from the University of North Carolina and her MPH from the University of Michigan. Her interests include access to and quality of contraceptive care in safety net clinics and data-based performance monitoring. Thanks so much for joining us today. The topic of my presentation is opportunities to monitor Title X service quality using data from the Family Planning Annual Report. I'd like to thank my co-author, Susan Muskowski, the Acting Director of the Office of Population Affairs, my colleague, Julia Gable at RTI, Commander Nancy Matoni Smith, a Public Health Advisor and Project Officer for the FPAR Compilation Project that I lead at RTI. I have no relationships to disclose. In terms of the structure of my presentation, I'll first start with a description of the Family Planning Report. I'll talk a little bit about how data flow upward from clinics to OPA via the FPAR data system and grantees. I'll talk about data analysis options based on levels of aggregation of that data. Then I'll talk about how FPAR data are used by OPA. Then I'll talk about the data and methods used in my analysis to show or demonstrate the opportunities for using the FPAR data to monitor service quality at the different levels. And then I will present findings and my conclusions. So what is the Family Planning Annual Report? So FPAR, for short, is the annual reporting requirement of all Title X service grantees. It consists of 15 tables. There's a grantee profile and 14 reporting tables. It is the only source of uniform reporting by Title X service grantees, and it provides OPA with consistent data aggregated for each grantee with the following information. It has information about the characteristics of each grantee's service network. And by service network, I mean the number of subrecipients that receive funding and the number of clinics that are supported with that funding. It also includes aggregate grantee level data on user demographic and social characteristics. That's user sex, user age, race, ethnicity, income levels, insurance status, and English proficiency status. It also includes information on use of contraceptive services and use of related preventive health services. And those related preventive health services include cancer screening activities, PAP and breast exam, and STD screening. There's information on clinical provider staffing, information on the utilization of family planning services as measured by the number of family planning encounters, and then project revenue. So this graphic presents a very simplified version of how data flow from Title X funded service sites to grantees and eventually to OPA via the FPAR data system. Because the FPAR data are administrative, they are collected during family planning encounters at the clinic level, which is the bottom row of this graph. I illustrate the upward flow of FPAR data using two examples. Grantee A on the left-hand side has subrecipient agencies and operates no clinics of its own. Subrecipient agencies under Grantee A compile and report data for their clinics to the grantee. These data may be aggregated by the subrecipient or reported to the grantee as encounter-level records. Grantee B on the right side has no subrecipient agencies and operates clinics directly. Grantee B compiles data for their own clinics. These are just two of several models that may exist for ways that a grantee obtains and reports up clinic-level data. To give you a sense of the extent to which the FPAR data are aggregated, in 2012, the FPAR data represent data from almost 4.8 million clients and 8.6 million family planning encounters. These data are aggregated across 4,189 service sites and 1,148 subrecipient agencies. The 93 grantees at the top level compile and report these data to OPA via the FPAR data system. Grantees are the entities responsible for compiling and reporting these data. The reporting of aggregate FPAR data by 93 grantees places limits on the types of analysis that can be performed. Analysis can be performed at four levels, including the national level, at the regional level, and by regional level, I mean combining states within the 10 HHS regions, and Christina showed a map at the beginning of the presentation. The data can be aggregated by state. If there are multiple grantees within a state, those data can be combined and analyzed at the state level. And then at the lowest level of, or the highest level of aggregation, or the lowest level that analysis is possible, is the grantee level. And there were 93 grantees in, 2012, that should read. With these data, we can examine trends and patterns in the FPAR data at these different levels. And for anyone interested in looking at the FPAR forms and instructions, they can be obtained on the OPA website. So how does OPA use the FPAR data? These data are used to monitor and manage program performance, to monitor compliance with statutory requirements, for example, priority in service delivery to low-income individuals. They're used by OPA to fulfill their accountability and federal performance requirements for the Title X funding. They're used in strategic and financial planning. They also help OPA to respond to inquiries about the program from policymakers in Congress. And they're used by OPA and analysts outside of OPA to estimate the impact of Title X funded activities on reproductive health outcomes, including unintended pregnancy and prevention of invasive cervical cancer. In terms of program monitoring, the FBAR data can be used to monitor priorities and key issues for the Title X program that relate to expanding access to effective and long-acting reversible contraception and ensuring the availability and provision of family planning and related preventive health care that is consistent with Title X requirements and nationally recognized standards of care. To show how the data can be used in this way, I'll be using FPAR data for 2005 through 2012, and I'm showing FPAR data just for the 50 states and the District of Columbia, and have excluded FPAR data that comes from 8 territories and jurisdictions in the Caribbean and the Pacific regions. In terms of methods, I've calculated performance on 2 measures, which I'll describe shortly. We'll look at national level data and trends for 2005 through 2012. We'll compare 2005 and 2012 data by age group for the contraceptive use measure and by region. And then for 2012, I will show aggregate state and then grantee level data. And so the measures of interest that we'll be looking at are the first one is a contraceptive use measure, the percentage of female clients at risk of unintended pregnancy that adopts or uses a highly or moderately effective reversible contraceptive at exit from their last encounter during the reporting period. So all of the contraceptive use tables that I'll be showing are based on reversible contraception, so LARCs or moderately effective methods. And the source for these for this measure is the FPAR Table 7. In terms of classifying methods by their level of effectiveness, we use the trestle tiers. So the highly effective reversible methods consist of IUD and implant, so LARCs. Moderately effective methods are short-term hormonal methods, injectable ring or patch, pills, diaphragm. And in terms of our denominator for our contraceptive use calculation, we're looking at females at risk of unintended pregnancy. And these are females who are not pregnant or seeking pregnancy. They are not sterilized or relying on a partner's vasectomy. Our second measure of interest is chlamydia testing, and we're looking at the percentage of female clients under 25 years that is tested for chlamydia at least once during the reporting period. And the reporting period for the FPAR is the calendar year. And the source of data for this measure is FPAR Table 11. All right, so let's see. In the next 9 slides, we present findings on the percentage of female users at risk of unintended pregnancy that use or adopt highly or moderately effective reversible methods at exit from their family planning encounter. And we're going to start with the national level data. In this slide, we look at national level trends in the percentage of at-risk clients that are using these methods for 2005 through 2012. And as you can see, since 2005, over two-thirds of at-risk females served by the program have been using or adopting at exit from the encounter a highly or moderately effective reversible contraceptive method. It's interesting that in 2005 and in 2012, the level was 68% in both years. In this chart, we break out highly effective methods to show their role in prevalence. The percentage using LARCs is shown along the bottom in the deeper red color. And as you can see, there's been a gradual increase from 2% in 2005 to 9% in 2012 in the percentage of at-risk females that are using these highly effective methods. In this next slide, we're looking at the percentage of at-risk clients under 30 years who are using highly or moderately effective reversible methods for 2005 versus 2012. The under 20-year group is shown on the left-hand side, the four bars. In the first set of bars, you see that in 2005, less than 1% of under 20 at-risk females were using highly effective methods. 68% were using moderately effective methods. By 2012, the percentage using highly effective methods had increased over 4 points to 5% of users under 20 relying on highly effective methods. And among women 20 to 29, the percentage using highly effective methods increased from 2% in 2005 to 10% in 2012. It was a slight reduction in the percentage using moderately effective methods. In this next slide, I have aggregated the grantee and state level data at the region level. And so running along the x-axis are the Title X the HHS regions. And for every region, there are two bar charts. The blue bar, The blue bar represents 2005 data, and the green bar represents 2012 data. And while this chart is busy and packed with information, its purpose is really to show how regions vary in the percentage of female users that are relying on highly or moderately effective methods. In 2005, this percentage varies from a low of 52% in Region 1 to a high of 81% in Region 8. And in 2012, the percentage varies from a low of 57% in Region 2 and a high of 82% in Region 8. This next slide just focuses on LARC use by region for these 2 years. Again, the blue bar shows the percentage for 2005, and the green bar shows the percentage for 2012. In 2005, use of LARCs across regions ranges between 1 and 4% of at-risk females, and in 2012, use increased to between 7 and 14%, and in all regions, there was an increase in LARC use during this time period. Okay, in this next slide, we've aggregated grantee level data at the state level. And what we did is, for each state, we then calculated the percentage of at-risk clients that were using highly or moderately effective methods. We sorted these states from low percentage to high percentage and divided them into five groups or five quintiles. The first quintile represents those states that have the lower percentage or the lowest percentage, and the fifth quintile, which is shown in the blue, shows those states with the highest percentage using highly or moderately effective methods. As you can see, the range across states in the percentage using highly or moderately effective methods during 2012 ranges from a low of 40%, to a high of 91%. And in this next slide, it's a related slide, but it's the same information, but focusing just on the percentage using highly effective methods. Again, we're showing state-level data, and we can see that percentage of LARC use across the states ranges between a low of 4% to a high of 20%, and that's not a very big span between the highest and the lowest LARC use. I also think it's worth pointing out some of the states that are in the fifth quintile. We have California, we have Massachusetts, we have Washington and Oregon, Iowa, and also Colorado. Some of those states have benefited from, concerted efforts to increase LARC use, and other states have had long-standing Medicaid waiver programs. And you can see that even with that investment in LARC use, the difference between the higher performing states and those in the lower quintile is not very big. In this next slide, we show data at the grantee level, and we've de-identified the grantees. But what you can see is that the percentage of clients using highly or moderately effective methods across all of the grantees ranges between a low of 35 to 91%, and that's a difference between the high and the low of about 56 percentage points, so quite a large variation.
Can I just ask a clarification question? So if a client gets, this is the number of clients that are seen in a given year.
Yes.
So it's not the prevalence. It's basically if a woman was seen this year and then next year she doesn't have to return because she got a LARC.
That's correct. That's correct. That's a good clarification. Thank you. And this next slide again shows grantee level data for 2012 for percentage of at-risk clients using highly effective reversible methods. And we can see that that ranges between a low of 1% to a high of 26%. In terms of chlamydia testing, this slide presents trends in chlamydia testing between 2005 and 2012 for females under 25. In 2005, that percentage was 50%, and that increased 9 points during the period to 59% in 2012. In this slide, we show chlamydia data at the regional level, 2005 versus 2012. The blue bar presents percentages tested in 2005, and the green bar represents those tested in 2012. And at first glance, we can see that there's quite a bit of variation in region-level testing rates across the years. And when we compare the blue and green bars for each of the regions, we find that screening increased in 6 regions and was level in 3 others during this period of time. And the percentage point increases were especially big in regions 8, 9, and 10. This chart shows chlamydia screening testing rates with data aggregated by state. Overall, chlamydia testing rates range between 35% to 78% across the 50 states and DC. There's a 43-point difference between states with the lowest and highest testing rates, so quite a big span. Now let me wrap up. The FPAR data are not perfect, and it's important to be explicit about their strengths and their weaknesses. In terms of FPAR data limitations, the data are aggregated at the grantee level, and that masks the diversity that exists across grantees, providers, and clinics. The FPAR data do not identify the many factors driving performance at the subrecipient and service site levels. And reporting errors at site level are difficult to detect when you're validating grantee level data. In terms of strengths, FPAR data are consistent, uniform data for all grantees and their service networks. They're available on an annual basis. There are a range of data elements describing the infrastructure, users, services, staffing, and revenue, and they allow for aggregation or analysis at national, regional, state, and grantee levels. FPAR data are an important source of information and have a role in monitoring Title X program performance on key quality measures. They can be used to identify trends, patterns, and emerging issues. But this brief and data-packed presentation has focused on several ways that FPAR data can be aggregated, sliced, and diced to examine Title X performance and selected quality measures. The analysis of the selected measures using data at lower levels of aggregation, specifically regional, state, and grantee, reveal wide variations in contraceptive use and chlamydia testing patterns. There was surprisingly less variation in the percentage using LARCs. What explains these variations? What factors enhance or hinder performance on these measures? How are states or grantees in the first and fifth quintiles different in ways that affect these measures? While FPAR data at these levels of aggregation cannot answer these questions, analysis of FPAR data in the ways that I've shown today can help to identify areas for further investigation. Oops, sorry. Hang on, how do I go back? There we go, sorry. Analysis of FPAR data in the ways that I've shown today can help to identify areas for further investigation, help to generate or refine questions for further study using data that are disaggregated at the subrecipient or site levels, help to focus program reviews and site visits, and help to identify potential topics for training and technical assistance. Thank you very much.
It's time for two questions for Christina.
Yes. Sure, yeah, that's a great question. So under our contract with the Office of Population Affairs, we prepare the national summary, which shows national level data, region level data, and then trend data at the national level, and then some state level data for selected indicators. And then there is a non-public report that goes out to every regional office. And in that report, we present comparative data across grantees. And grantees all receive a copy of this. So they get information at the national level for their region, and then for every grantee. And that's done for every FPAR table. But that's not shared with the public. Yes.
Christina, hey, Lee Warner.
Hi, Lee.
Yes. This is great. I always wanted to know how the system was set up, so it was fabulous. I've got two related questions. One, this is a powerhouse system that I wonder how nimble it is. So maybe it's not nimble. It's like our systems at CDC. But I'll give you two examples. You've got the new guidance we're publishing together, hopefully late this year. But are you able to capture some of how often some of these services are used? So how often are fertility services provided or preconception care services? So that's the first question. Is there any way how can we maximize use of FPAR providing the guidance? My second one is, again, it's going to the powerhouse idea of this. You can easily test the effectiveness of different interventions in clinics, because you have the infrastructure there. Is there any way to get to beyond the grantee to the clinics? So maybe we don't need to know it at the government level, but could a grantee be assigned six clinics to a waiting room intervention and six others not to do it, and see how it affects use of services, client volume, etc. The hard part is to have a system in place, and you have that.
Well, were you planted? I'll let OPA answer that, and I know that Kathy is going to touch on some of those issues.
So the current system is fabulous in many ways, but it does have a lot of limitations, and so we are looking right now. I've been in the process for almost 2 years of talking about revising it to be more performance-oriented and to actually start collecting at the national level, visit level, encounter data that we could better, more nimbly respond to, you know, the types of analyses that you're describing. So that's our longer-term vision. It's a big overhaul. It's going to be costly and take a number of years, but that's where we want to go. We really want to go to a more performance-oriented and reactive program, and we also want the grantees to be able to use their own data and to have that kind of dashboard view and be able to benchmark across grantees. It's really our hope in the coming years. And Kathy's going to describe next the Region 1 data system, which feeds into FPAR, that has a lot of those features that we really are fans of at headquarters. Okay, so let me see if I can get to her presentation. Oh, no. Okay, let me try the desktop. Did you put it on the desktop? No? Uh-oh. It's like, it's all like grayed out. Oh. Shoot. Yeah, this doesn't seem to actually be loaded. This looks like it's from the desktop, because it didn't look like the other one, so.